Well, let me add my thanks to those that have already been given to the organisers for this event, and I think the size of the audience indicates very well that there is a continuing active interest in the External Action Service. On behalf of academics, I should thank the creators of the service for at least seeing me through to retirement. Let me very briefly introduce our speaker for this session, who, as you see from the biography in the programme, Cesare Onestini is head of the Corporate Board Secretariat in the European External Action Service. And for those of you who carry a copy of the organogram with you, it's in the heart of the service.
Spot it.
It is, absolutely. It just, it's one bit of the organogram that I can now tick off in terms of having met somebody from that component of the service. And clearly, as in that role, it's a kind of central to the activities of the corporate board. And also in a previous role, of course, you worked in the EU delegation to the UN in New York. Now, when I was looking at the structure of the program, I don't know whether this is a sign of the times and how the service has moved on, but in terms of tackling practical problems and prospects, there's only 1 hour, which that must suggest that progress has really been made from what people have been saying about the service, certainly since its creation. We all look very much forward to hearing the problems that have been solved, the ones that arise, but also, as ambitiously, the issues of prospects for the service itself. So thank you, Cesare.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks to the organizer and to David and the various sponsors of the conference for having me here. Let me start with two disclosures, like the Americans say. Disclosure number one, I was a commission official for 15 years and I enjoyed it very much. And as such, I was in no doubt with, and I was funding intercultural education project, working in trade policy, working on the energy dialogue with Russia, or working in the delegation in UN. I had no doubt that I was working in a political environment. And disclosure number two, I've been with the External Action Service for the past 2 years, and I've enjoyed it just as much. So I hope I'll bring to the discussion this direct experience of the last couple of years in setting up the service, trying to give you an insider's view how things have been perceived from the inside in the setting up process. It's a bit late in the day, so I'll try to sketch out some of the big questions without opening too much to details, and then if there is time for questions, or indeed tomorrow I'll be around, I'm very happy to explore a bit more some of the issues I'm going to mention quite briefly today. First point I'd like to make is that the External Action Service, which is a bit where Robert Cooper ended, was created at a time of incipient crisis within the European Union. And the context of the crisis, not just the euro crisis, but more generally sense of the closing of a phase of the integration process and the possibly the opening of another one, is something that has to be borne in mind to understand what was happening. But not only that, it had been a long time in the making, not just the 20 years, but also through a process which you remember just as much as I do, which involved a convention, a constitution, referenda that failed, and somehow a sense that this project had been pushed up the hill and then had gone down again. And the Treaty of Lisbon brought it up again, but there was a sense of, well, have we lost the momentum and are we ready now to go? At the same time, through the process of the Convention and the Constitution, we have collectively raised the expectations quite dramatically, not simply within the Union, and external relations was very much at the forefront of the presentations of the Constitution, but also vis-a-vis third countries. In New York, the year before the Treaty of Lisbon entered into force, we spent a year telling people how much things will change, how the Treaty of Lisbon was putting some order into the representation of the Union, how the Treaty of Lisbon was going to streamline, simplify, do away with the Troika system, and somehow we collectively gave the impression that this was a brave new world where things will look completely different. Well, I think the continuity aspect was underplayed, and we had to face a situation of, to some extent, unreasonably high expectations, compounded by the fact that the process of adoption of the Treaty of Lisbon on the heels of the failed referenda meant that we were not allowed to do any preparations in Brussels because we could not prejudge the outcome of this renewed effort at intergovernmental level. So whilst the convention had, in the constitution, draft constitution, had indicated that as soon as the document was signed, the high representative, the commission, should get down to business and start preparing for the new structures, in the interregnum between the convention and the constitution and the Treaty of Lisbon, we were actually told that we should not do any preparation lest be seen as prejudging the outcome of the referenda that were to come. So there was, it's not that people in Brussels were not ready because they were, you know, taken by surprise, but it was a very political process that led to this situation. So this is where we start 2.5 years ago, or 3 years ago now, when Lady Ashton was appointed. At the same time, and I will not go into that at all now, but there is a wider changing context of diplomacies, agendas, global issues, climate change, all of that, which means that the national systems themselves are going through their own soul searching. And it means that even in Brussels, if you look at what was happening in Brussels before, you will see that your traditional line department had been building up over the previous decade quite significant external relations expertise. You have, if you add up the number of people working in external relations writ large, in transport, in energy, in education, and so on and so forth, you come to a fairly sizable number of people who were already there doing this work, mirroring what's happening also, I think, in many national settings. The backdrop was not simply this, but also last year, a time of quite dramatic changes within the immediate neighborhood and the Arab Spring. So there was a sense of the External Action Service coming into being at a time when the expectations were not just high in terms of a general role or presentation or so, but also very immediately there was a need in the media as well to show that this Europe was answering, was visible, was filling the space, especially given that the Americans themselves were leaving some of this space open. So there was a sense that eyes were pointed on the European Union and what could be done. So to go back to this, the High Representative was appointed, and she had, in the space of a few months, the time to set up the service through the adoption of a legally binding decision that she had to draft, and she had to get through agreement with the Parliament, consultations, agreement with the Commission, and get through the Council. This process, obviously, that many people at the beginning of her mandate felt could take much longer, was dealt with quite speedily. So I would say, looking back now, we take it for granted, but at the time of her appointment, it was not for granted. It was actually quite a long discussion that took place in Brussels, and it was not easy to combine all these different components. It was not easy to bring in together in this new institution, in terms of financial affairs, at least we are an institution, in terms of other things not, but into this new body, it was not easy to combine the military dimension, the crisis management dimension, the commission heritage, together with the space that had to be left open and filled as quickly as possible for the member states' diplomats. Moreover, merely in terms of setting up a body, an institution, a service, however you want to call it, the fact that the political decision had been that it could not be part of the Commission, could not be part of the Council Secretariat, had to be self-standing, but had to be budget neutral, meant that the conditions for setting up the service were pretty tight. There wasn't much margin. You really had to work very hard to make ends meet in terms of squaring the different circles. And I'll spare you the details, but the way in which we have done it is setting up a system of service level agreements with the Commission, with the Council, for the provision of all the basic services so that we could concentrate on the policy without having to reinvent the wheel. We didn't need our own medical service. We didn't need our own system for payments. All of that has been done, but had to be done in the space of a very short few weeks. The Treaty of Lisbon, however, had entered into force immediately in the delegations. So it took a year to set up things in Brussels, but in the delegations, the Treaty of Lisbon entered into force immediately on the day of appointment of Catherine Ashton. What meant is that what this meant was that locally, the EU delegation, whenever they could, whenever they were present and they had sufficient staff, took on the role of representing, speaking on behalf, coordinating, delivering the marches on behalf of the European Union. And this was done for a whole year without having the mothership in place back at home. We had the High Representative, her staff, working very hard in setting up the legal decision and appointments of the first big bosses so that the service could start in January 2011. But under that, we had still DG RELEX, DG Development, the Council Secretariat, and the different structures, and delegations had to make up a little bit the connections between the different systems. And what happened? It worked out very well. I don't think any of us expected such a smooth transition in delegations. In a place like New York, which is also, as was said by other speakers, one of the difficult multilateral delegations, it was quite amazing to see how member states were ready to go to the permanent representation through the EU delegation, and from day one, they committed and engaged in trying to find ways to represent this within the UN structures as well, so that there would be compatibility between what we had decided would be our way of speaking collectively and the UN rules on the other end. As you know, we ended up with a resolution in the General Assembly. This was not the case everywhere, and I think Geneva, and tomorrow maybe we'll hear about Geneva, was the counterexample, but in most of the third country delegations, the bilateral postings, this was very much the case. There was a very smooth transition, which has carried on so far. When we started last year, so a year and a half ago, a bit more now, almost two, with the setting up of the service at headquarters, priority number one was, from our point of view, was business continuity. And business continuity is not just status quo. It was trying to say we have operations and missions in third countries on the ground. We have literally troops on the ground. We had the delegations that are working. We had a number of commitments with third countries in terms of political dialogues, political commitments, summits coming up. We had to make sure that the transition would not end up in a period of 6 months, 12 months of chaos and trying to find our feet and telling the world, well, wait, we are not ready yet. So that was the main preoccupation. And we decided quite rationally not to go for a big bang, not to go for a complete transformation, but really build on what we had. I don't think it's correct to say that we simply inherited the Commission way of doing things, because all of the Council crisis management structures were transferred en bloc. So the EU military staff, the civilian crisis management part, the CMPD, the INSEN, all of these structures that were in the Council Secretariat were taken and transferred, and all the procedures relating to them remained untouched. So they were not changed on day one, and we said explicitly we don't do it because we want this to continue working, and we'll be looking at it in the course of the first year and the second year to see how we can integrate it. And that's where we are now. So we did immediately a screening of resources. We wanted to make sure that the people coming in from the Council Secretariat and the Commission coming together would not end up duplicating the same work. We saw that there was some overlap, but not dramatic. And there was some overlap in some areas, like on the Middle East peace process, on the Balkans. There were people covering the same countries and performing similar tasks. So we tried to look at that quite quickly in the first 3-4 months, and this is the 10% efficiency gain we were asked to do. And the 10% efficiency gain was not that we had to then give up the post, but we had to reattribute these 10% to new tasks. And that's the important thing. The important thing is that there was a lot of new coming into the service. And these new tasks were not simply in terms of coordination or representation in third countries, but very much also in the way in which we work in Brussels. Because the appointment of Catherine Ashton as president of the chair of the Foreign Affairs Council meant that also all the preparatory working groups under the Foreign Affairs Council were now chaired by the External Action Service and required a different way of operating. And we had to fill the role that had been traditionally the role of the rotating six-monthly presidency. And in this budget neutrality approach, we had to find the resources to do this within what we had inherited from Commission and Council and the 30% of posts that we had to make available for the member states. But remember, the 30% of posts were not 30% of new posts. We had to create this, and the number of new posts was quite limited. We only got a third of what we were asking. We only got about 100 new posts, and that's all we had to make room for the member states. So that's what I meant when I say we had very little margin. The decision, therefore, to find the 10% efficiency gain and put it onto these coordination tasks was not a decision that we could play around with. We had to do it. Secondly, we also decided from the very beginning that the raison d'etre of the External Action Service was in having a wide and performing network of delegations. So of the new posts that we got, and there were not very many, some were used for the filling up of these new tasks at headquarters, but the vast majority of these posts were put immediately into delegations. And all the new posts that we got last year, including a transformation of headquarters to delegations posts, were all transferred to delegations. This explains why, when you look at the presence of member states diplomats, most of them are out in delegations, because we decided that all the posts that we were getting and all the posts that we were squeezing out of the system would go to strengthen the delegations, because we feel that is the real value added of what we do. In terms of the first year, there was a big recruitment drive that some people say distracted us from other things, but it had to be done. It had to be done because member states were rightly saying, well, the role of the member states diplomats inside need to be there from the beginning. If it takes you 3-4 years to reach the 30%, well, we missed the boat. We need to be there from the beginning, and you need to make that space for us. And if you look at what we have done, it has been done very fairly. Member states have been very cooperative. We have freed up a number of key posts that became available in terms of heads of divisions for key for example, heads of divisions with the U.S., heads of divisions for China, they became available so that we made sure that member states had the presence in the service that was expected and that could really start playing a role at this role of cross-fertilization, working together, focusing more maybe on defining the priorities and the needs of the service. We also had to work and then there is a whole dynamic of the appointments and the nominations and the system we set up together with the Commission, the Council, and the Member States. We have a panel that selects, for example, for heads of delegations, the candidates, and then the appointments are done by the High Representative. All of this was done in full transparency with the Member States and indeed with their participation. We also had to spend quite some energy on defining the relations with the Commission, with the Council, and with the Parliament. And I will only talk briefly about relations with the Commission. I think this light obsession about turf war with the Commission is confusing a little bit the picture. The Commission had genuine interest in saying, we have been doing a number of things for a number of years with the community method, meaning we have been working in, indeed, a supranational context. We have produced policies, and we have decision-making systems which imply that in many of these areas, we decide on a qualified majority basis. We have no consensus. We decide talking together, but then there is a decision which is taken and which is the binding decision for the European Union. And the Commission was saying, we do not want, with the creation of the External Action Service, to lose this, because this has been the value added of the community methods all these years. So what the Commission was trying to preserve was not turf, but was what it was put there to do. The Commission has been created to define and bring forward this common purpose. Obviously, then, you have personalities, you have to define procedures. David O'Sullivan often said the first year is a bit like a divorce, you know, the commission, and you start having fights, you know, who has the kids. In this case, nobody wanted the kid. We were throwing things back and forth. You know, it was a bit of that kind of dynamic, but which is not unlike the dynamics between DG DEFCO and DG Trade within the commission, which is not unlike the dynamics between ministries in national systems. Now there is the added complication of maybe having slightly different legal advice, because once we are all in the commission, the legal service of the commission becomes the arbiter on some of the questions. Now we have legal service of the commission, legal service of the council, some legal capacity ourselves, and there might be different views because they emanate from the different logics. Each of these institutions has been created with a reason. And the legal services as well represent this reason, not blindly, and if they did so, we wouldn't be able to do anything, but trying to bring it together. The fact also that the Commission has so much personnel in delegations, well, that's life. That's where we started. The delegations were set up to deliver aid and to deliver community policies, and the External Action Service has only just been added on to these dynamics. So the fact that this personnel is there is not a sign that the Commission is not leaving the space for the External Action Service, but it's where we are coming from. And the fact that the heads of delegations have authority over all of the personnel of the delegation shows clearly that the Commission is playing along. The Commission, on the other hand, has a responsibility to its own staff wherever the staff is. So in terms of careers and promotions and so on, it has been said it is true that the careers of Commission officials remains within the Commission, but we wouldn't want to start managing the careers of all those few thousand extra people. We want to concentrate on the job we have to do, which is defining and carrying out the common foreign policy and working with the High Representative, with the President of the European Council, with Barroso, in defining the external action of the Union and bringing the coherence and so on and so forth that other people have talked about. Now, a couple of words on challenges, and I'll stop there. If I look at where we are now, I think challenge number one, as been said by many people, is the need to strengthen coherence. And strengthening coherence, not just in terms of commission competencies and external relations competencies and so on, but really in trying to become this factory of ideas that has been talked about, trying to do the best possible analysis, trying to capitalize a bit on the expertise of the national diplomats, of the commission expertise, of the council secretariat, of the intelligence community through the INSEN, of the crisis management colleagues through the crisis management capabilities we have, and trying to bring in together to see how we can tackle different questions. And this is not something that can be done in a few months. It's very much a job in the making. And the focus that we have now, for example, on the comprehensive approach, there will be a communication of the High Representative in the Commission on the comprehensive approach, which we are drafting now, goes in this direction. It's really trying to show that we are trying to see how we can do this better, how can we work on these issues better. Same, not simply internally, but also with other partners, with strategic partners, with the UN. How can we work better in this case? And with the UN, the last few years have shown that there are different ways of cooperating. We have quite a few examples also of operations on the ground that have been started by the EU, taken over by the UN, and vice versa. So the wealth of examples is there. We need to build on that. And the discussions we're having, for example, on the Sahel now show the extent of this cooperation on the ground, UN, regional organization, African Union, ECOWAS in this case, and so on and so forth. Secondly, there is the question of really truly speaking with one voice and becoming not just an additional voice, but trying to bring this EU view to some of the big issues. And the consensus is what everybody always wishes for, but consensus requires quite a lot of daily work, requires regular consultations, requires exchanges of views, requires getting the member states in Brussels together regularly in the different council working groups, and requires the External Action Service to develop ideas and bring new ideas to the table so that we can move together. And on some issues, obviously, those are the ones that make the headlines. There is no consensus. The discussion in on Palestine coming up in the General Assembly in New York is one such divisive issue. And it's true that we have to face the political realities of where the member states are, but we have to work with that. So the challenge of speaking with one voice is not simply a theoretical challenge, but it's also how you get there, how you define priorities, how you move towards those priorities, and that's where it's really the role of the presidency that we have taken over mechanically. We now need to also bring to a more strategic level, setting priorities that go maybe beyond the 6-monthly routine we have inherited, and trying to have a little bit more of planning and a midterm forward vision. And slightly, the question of structures. That remains a challenge in terms of, for example, the dynamic with the member states, the 4+4 secondment, integration of member states diplomats. It's not a given. What's going to happen after the first 4 years? We have a 30% a requirement of national diplomats, but we also have a 60% requirement of permanent staff. So the 30% might go up to 40%, and that becomes the ceiling. What does it mean when you get to that ceiling? Does it mean that any new vacancy will not be open to member states anymore? What happens after the end of the 4 years? What we are trying to do, for example, is to say to everybody, all personnel in the External Action Service, at least all policy-level personnel, that there must be compulsory mobility every 4 years. Doing what? In some cases, has been said, maybe we are standardizing ourselves to foreign ministry, but we have a need to make sure that there is this internal mobility to sync with the member states' rhythm of 4-year postings within us. We also then need to see with the member states, and the member states have to decide for themselves, what do they want to do with their diplomats after the 4 years? Do they want to keep them for a second 4-year posting? If they all do this, theoretically, there will be no new member states diplomat coming in for the next 8 years. As soon as we get to the 30 to 40% quota, the numbers then will dwindle down, and that will be it. And then there will be a new wave after 8 years. What happens after 8 years of a national diplomat in Brussels? What do they find back? Do they have a career when they go back? That's a real question for the colleagues in the national systems, and one that we are trying to discuss with them informally, trying to find solutions. We also have a question of improving the quality of our resources, and that means training. That means, for example, developing a real security culture that in Brussels is probably not as developed as it should be, especially in some of the structures that we have. We have to develop mediation capability. We have to develop some of the qualities that are needed, and that by bringing in national diplomats, but also by opening up the recruitment when we come to the end of the one-third commitment, we hope we'll be able to bring in through open competitions as we do for other institutions in Brussels. Lastly, my personal view of the, having worked now for a couple of years inside the External Action Service, is that this dynamic with the member state presence, with the commission personnel and the experience of the commission personnel, and indeed with the colleagues coming from the Council Secretariat, to me is probably the blueprint for a certain way forward for the European Civil Service, which needs to integrate all these elements, needs to bring them together. Maybe this is not the perfect formula. Maybe this is needs to be revised. The review, it's an opportunity that we have. One small correction, is not a midterm review. I hope it's not midterm, because after 2 years, otherwise we'll be in business very short. It's a review in 2013. And this review will allow us, I hope, to correct some of these of the things that we saw need correction. But I think overall, it's pointing, in my view at least, to a new way of developing these dynamics at European level and working together with member states. And I wouldn't be too surprised if in a few years we see some of these also in other spheres, like the economic sphere, so on and so forth, where member states and European level need to work much more hand in hand.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Cesare. One or two observations, perhaps, before we throw open for questions. I guess the question for me is how far the sort of startup phase of the service will be important in conditioning the sort of functioning and the culture of the service forevermore. I guess it's a question for historians of the service, how far this is some kind of interregnum, and perhaps there are unusual things happening which won't characterize how it plays itself over the next few years. But I guess one of the issues that you did flag up for us was the kind of external context. There's never going to be a good period of time in which to establish something that deals with foreign policy, of course, because there's always a crisis around the corner. But I think one of the things about the service, and you pointed out the long duration from, let's say, the conception of the service to when it formally started up, that was a period in which, let's say, at the start, there was a high degree of optimism about Europeans' capacity to change the world beyond themselves, to a period now in which, let's say, the optimism about Europeans' capacity to have influence in the world beyond themselves is rather diminished. So perhaps the service has to work harder than might already been might have originally been envisaged. And of course, the nature of diplomacy itself has changed quite dramatically over the last 10-year period, not least the cost constraints, but also the other issues that have already been flagged up in terms of competing sources of information. Issues requiring attention, and the sort of centralization or the pattern of centralization of diplomacy around presidents and prime ministers that's become perhaps even more reinforced. Two other sets of issue, if I may, that for me are questions for how far the startup phase provides indicators to the future is some interinstitutional competition. We had this institution emerge, a kind of new planetary body that didn't fit into the universe of institutions, and others, as well as you, have sort of flagged up how these relationships have had to be struck with the Commission, the Parliament, and other actors. How far the kinds of relationships that have been struck during the startup phase, the kind of issues that have been the consequence of tussles, also mark the future or near-term future relationship between the institutions, and particularly in the context of the reshuffle in 2014 and the change of personnel, whether that's a kind of opportunity for some institutional actors to perhaps grab back some power that they feel they might have lost. Also, an issue that I know others in this room have studied quite closely, the sort of integration challenge, the challenge of integrating individuals from different backgrounds, again, which you touched on, and you also, raised the issue of sort of skills and skill set, again, which has come out in previous sessions, and the sort of institutional blend and the issues of nationality, background, and so on. And one of the things, it obviously hasn't been a first-order concern of the service to address those, but perhaps you could talk a little bit about how you look to do so in the future through training and so on. And perhaps the last issue, which is, I think, one of interest to practitioners and to academics, is a kind of benchmarking question. How are you going to benchmark your success in the future? What's the model for the service organizationally? What's the model of the service in terms of, let's say, the entrepreneurial role you want to play in ideas that you touched on, but also the benchmarking against other member state services, and let's say sort of how much of the action you see yourselves getting as opposed to national actors, but also other third country diplomatic services and so on. So, but I'd be really interested is whether there's any kind of emerging idea of who you're measuring yourselves against, your peer group, if you like. And I'll stop there, if I may. Let's open up. Rosa. Thank you. Okay. Just Rosa, please.
Thank you very much. Rosa Balfour from the European Policy Centre in Brussels. That was very interesting, so I'd like to thank you. There are a few things I'd like to ask you. The first is, if I said that in issues relating to Commission and External Action Service relations, in areas where the External Action Service clearly leads, i.e. sort of more foreign policy issues, but where it requires Commission cooperation in order to implement whatever policy they've devised, the level of cooperation has been increasingly better. Whereas in areas which fall under Commission competence, but the external dimension, cooperation has not been quite so good because the Commission has been more reluctant to bring in the External Action Service. Would you agree with this? That's my question. That's my first question. Second, regarding structures and staffing and the 30% objective from member states, are you thinking of addressing these issues in the review process? And what other issues? What is the review process as it stands now, as you know, the ideas that are being developed now? What other kind of issues is the review process going to be addressing? Is it going to be bureaucratic issues, staffing issues, personnel policies, or something more than that? So I suppose, put differently, what level of ambition is there at the moment in the corporate board, shall we say, with regard to the review process?
Thank you. I'd like to take two more and then come back, if I may, at the back over here.
Lars-Erik Lundin, I'll come back tomorrow with discussing the Vienna delegation. But just one question to you, Cesare, because you can probably help us to set the record a bit more straight on the what one may call the quality of the resource base. You mentioned the people coming from the Commission and the people coming from the member states. Now, my own experience, having worked in the RELECs before the entry into force, was that almost all my staff had a national diplomatic background. Almost all my staff, including myself. They were simply recruited to the Commission, and the younger people who came in during the last 15 years, the last 15 countries who joined the EU, were absolutely top class from their foreign ministries. I mean, the young people who went through the general concours was the crème de la crème of the national diplomatic services who went to Brussels, to the Commission and to the Council Secretariat at that time. Same was in Vienna. Almost all my staff had a national diplomatic training and a national diplomatic background, somewhere between 5 and 10 years before they had qualified to go into service. Some went in also as national experts. So my question is there... Yeah, has anybody done any statistics on this? How many people actually from the Commission services do already have the requisite national diplomatic training that we have asked them to get?
Here, please.
Richard Seaboom, I used to work for the Quakers in Brussels. Very interested in the training side of things. In the papers we were given to look at, there was a lovely journalistic article about the culture of the US State Department, in which it says that the culture is almost non-existent and nobody goes in for accountability or anything like that. I think you've addressed this to some extent in things you and other people have said already. But you can't sort of take people away on training courses in this emergency, in this sort of startup situation. Or is how are you actually promoting a common culture?
Yes, thank you for the questions. And to make my life easier, I just want to answer them as Chatham House. If you can delete everything from your podcasts of these questions, it makes my life easier. And also it makes it a bit more interesting. For example, in terms of training, as you all know from whatever institution you are coming from, including universities, training is always the last thing people talk about. And they talk about it, you know, we need it, it's important, and blah, blah, and then it's what is going to you know, we'll do it tomorrow. It's a bit the case in the External Action Service as well, not because people think it's not essential, but because it's the kind of thing you feel you don't need immediately. You can kind of think about it a bit the day after. It's only part of a characterization. This is because we have inherited the training systems that were there for Commission, for Council. We had inherited a system which had already been developed with the member states to open diplomatic training offered in member states to staff in Brussels. So we had already options to do this. And what we have done in Brussels in this first couple of years has been to focus much more on the pre-posting training that we offer for all the staff going out to delegations, because that has been priority number one. And that's also where we have put most of the new posts that we got. So to be very clear, when we get, for example, heads of delegations appointed coming from the Slovakia or the Czech Republic or so, some of them would have been in Brussels before and would have knowledge. Some of them would not necessarily have that knowledge, and it's very important for them to have that training and get that knowledge before they go out and speak on behalf of the European Union. There is, as this conference has shown, quite a degree of complexity in the institutional setup that you need to master before you can go and shake hands with a foreign minister and speak on behalf of the Union. There is also a little footnote there. The heads of delegations go out also for the Commission, so they have a specific and personal financial responsibility, so they really have to master some of the basic concepts that applied in the European context of managing sums of money. So those kind of issues have been focused on. I think what we need is to do a bit more on the wider needs. For example, we don't have a policy on learning non-European languages. We don't have a policy on security training. We have a fairly basic security training for staff. So things like that do need to be looked again and improved. We do have a course, for example, though, for political reporting that the Commission itself had started a few years back, and that has been very successful. It has trained a number of Commission staff that had been doing political reporting for many years, and it was run by national diplomats, retired, usually ambassadors from some of the member states. In terms of the quality of resources and the question between member states, personnel, and Commission or Council, my sense, and this is my personal sense, is that there is not a different quality, and there is not even necessarily a different kind of experience in terms of bringing in completely different ways of doing things. What's really interesting is that you bring in completely different networks, and people are there having worked in an environment that gave them access to different types of people, different type of cultures. If you were embedded if you were posted in a member state bilateral delegation somewhere, you would have met a number of people that probably somebody from the Commission in the same post would have not covered, because your interests were different. You were therefore with a slightly different agenda. So there is a bit of an overlap, but the real interesting thing is to bring these networks. The other interesting thing, speaking frankly, is that some of the member states coming in are plugged in still in their own systems of information exchanges with their own ministries. So when you sit around a table and you have a German, a Slovakian, you have an Italian around the table, and they bring to the table, obviously, with all the rules, whatever the rules are in their systems of confidentiality and all that, but they tell you, well, I think, you know, maybe we should look at this thing in this way. They're also telling you that there is something that is being discussed somewhere else and that you need to be aware of. And that's where the cross-fertilization is happening, and that's why it's important to have the 30% member state. I'm not one of these people who say I can spot the difference of a report if it has been written by a commission, a council, or so. You know, I'm sorry, that's not true. But what I am convinced is that the member state colleague can bring a slightly different angle because of the experience, and can bring a slightly different expertise because he or she would be in touch, or would have been in touch up to recently, with a slightly different set of people. And also they have different career interests. You know, they want to go back to their systems because they know they're only here for 4 years, so they do keep and cultivate all of that. They're also maybe better at cultivating some of the quite numerous accredited third country diplomats in Brussels. And that's something the Commission was not very good at in the past. And that's true. The Commission somehow was perceived more as a diplomatic actor by third countries accrediting themselves to the Union because they wanted to be there and they saw the value of being there, whilst even DG RELEX was not particularly good at reciprocating and doing what you would experience in third countries where the foreign ministry would have regular sessions with accredited third country diplomats. In Brussels, we have not been very good at that, and we are trying to improve on that. So I don't think we need to go into statistics of different people. They don't tell us very much, because the quality, it's of a different nature. And the reality is that, as you have some excellent people from the Commission or from the Council, from the Member States, you also have some not excellent people from the Council, the Commission, and the Member States coming in. With the Member States, obviously, they're only there for 4 years, so that's the advantage. With the permanent staff, you know, it's a bit more difficult. On the question of the Commission being more recalcitrant to involve the External Action Service, I think it's what I was trying to say at the beginning. The Commission has a role in the treaty, and the role is there to defend the common interest and to work in the supranational environment and work on the basis of qualified majority voting where they can. The Commission's main fear is that what's happening now is that there is unanimity through the back door. I mean, that's what I perceive. That's why the Commission is being a bit recalcitrant. And as was said, one of the member states not far from here blocked all the EU statements for a number of months because they felt that all of a sudden statements had to become EU and member states and all of that. It's a fair point, but it's a point obviously that brings in a new dimension. And what does it mean? It means that all of a sudden you're saying, even if there is a policy that has been agreed in Brussels at the European level, in the Environment Council, so not by the Commission on its own, but with the member states, now what we're saying is that before you do anything on that and you go and do a démarche abroad and you act on it, you need to go back and ask the 27 permissions to do it, and you need to frame it. And there is another counter-argument that says, well, but obviously you have to do it because the EU delegation out there now speaks on behalf of the Union. So you cannot just pretend you are simply representing the communities like in the past. So the two arguments have foundations and are legally sound, and that's why they are, it's an argument, but that's why the Commission, I think, is ultimately a bit recalcitrant. It's not because they feel there is a grab of competence, but because they feel there is a step back. I don't share this view. I think that the step back makes you jump a bit further, because by transforming positions into EU positions and positions that are shared by the member states and have to be owned by the member states, you are that bit more effective and you're that bit more taken seriously when you go out and you démarche a third country, if you do it not just on behalf of the EU, which is a bit of an abstract concept in some cases, especially in some countries, but if you go and you do it on behalf also of your 27 member states, possibly sometimes with one or two of them, depending on the local situation, then that carries some weight. So I don't share this view of the Commission, but that explains a little bit this feeling. And again, it's not turf war for the sense of, oh, no, you shouldn't do it because I'm here. It's more like, well, you know, I don't want to see a step back because we have obviously fought hard to get where we are. On the issues for the review, I cannot tell you very much because there is not very much to tell yet. I mean, the review is obviously something that interests a lot the academic world and will become something a bit more important also for us as we move forward. And as Robert Cooper said, we need to take it seriously. It's something that we need to do by mid next year. The High Representative is the one who has to draft it and present it. She will have some first discussions with the member states in informal settings, probably sometime in spring. That will define as well the parameters of the review. There are some inputs, as you know. There is a letter of 12 countries of last year. There is the Westerwelle report. There are all sorts of things out there that one could start looking at, but there is no mechanism at the moment to start vetting all of this. I think there is no review industry, at least on our side. I get the feeling there is a bit of a review industry somewhere else building up, but we'll deliver a review, and the High Representative will be the one who delivers the review, and hopefully will be something that meets these different expectations. The question of whether this will lead to changes of the legal basis or not is something that we don't know now. I mean, we know there are some things we need to change. Whether it requires a legal change or not, it's another question. I mean, if we go, as Robert mentioned, into the direction of deputies or so, I don't think that's even that's even of a higher order than a review of the EEAS. I mean, the review of the EEAS is looking at the decision that was set up, the treaty, and what we were told to do, and we'll stay within that framework, I assume, and there might be some issues that are identified on which you say, oh, well, maybe that means we need to look at the question of deputies or so, but that's, personally, I think it's something that is difficult to predict now. We see as we move on. And lastly, on some of the remarks made at the beginning, on the startup phase obviously has an impact. I think the startup phase, though, in the way we have framed it, is not going to be the beginning and the end. I mean, it is a startup phase, and we are very clear that there is going to be the need for adjustment. There is going to be the need to come back to the structure or the organization regularly, review or no review. I mean, there will be a review next year, but I'm sure that the year after we'll also be looking at the way in which we work and operate. The 2014 change of personalities and political appointments, obviously it's a moment which is important, but to me, what's more important is the way in which the next president of the Commission is going to be chosen, because that's really what's going to determine the political dynamics in Brussels. Is he or she going to be, maybe she, an emanation of the political majority in the parliament in one way or another, as some people want, or is it going to be more according to the current system? That's going to change slightly the dynamics. I don't think we are there yet, but you know, politics might surprise us. But more than the choice of the personality, because you know, the choice of the personality of the High Representative, you know, people have different theories always, but it's the same as the choice of the personality of the President of the Commission. And you have people who had great expectations perform very well, people who came in with low expectations and did a fantastic job. That's going to be, and usually that's not the main criteria the member states use. As you know, the horse trading for these political appointments is seen as a package. So you will have a question of gender, you will have a question of geography, of east, west, north, south, you will have a question of political families, and in the pot you will have the President of the European Council, the President of the Commission, and the High Representative. This will be what comes out, and then you can interpret whoever gets the High Representative job in many different ways, but the horse trading will have been about, you know, woman, man, east, west, experience, non-experience, economic portfolios versus non-economic portfolios, as people, many of you been in Brussels longer than me, you know better than me. Lastly, just a word, because I haven't said it before, but we as External Action Service actually work quite closely with the two presidents, with President Barroso and President Van Rompuy. And it's part of the mandate of the service, but the preparation of summits, the preparation of all their visits to third countries, the preparation of all their bilateral meetings is done by us, with their respective cabinets, private offices, but they do not have the geographic expertise or thematic expertise to prepare this. So it's done really through the service. Same thing for the neighborhood policy. We work with Commissioner Füle as much as we work with High Representative Ashton, and we work pretty much directly. Same thing for programming of development instruments, working with Commissioner Piebalgs. So the External Action Service is not just a pyramid working solely for the High Representative, but it covers, as seen, as envisaged in its own decision, it covers this wider spectrum. And some of my colleagues spend quite a lot of their time on this, so it's important to put it in the picture. Last point I wanted to do, on benchmarking, I think it's for academics at the moment. I think we are not at benchmarking yet. You should tell us what benchmarks we should do. Maybe you can give us some examples of what foreign ministries do to benchmark themselves, or some other, or the UN. I've seen the UN trying to discuss the way in which they measure themselves for many years, and they're not any further than we are. But on the question of the integration challenge, and I know there is some talk about different cultures coming together and people remaining a bit in the frame of mind, so a national diplomat will still work in that frame of mind, a commission official will have a hard time to move on. The reality for me is that in order to be performing well in the External Action Service, you need to do certain things. You need to serve a common interest. You need to push the agenda a bit further. You should not be minimum common denominator. You should try to listen, but at the end, listen to all the different views and trying to come up with a view that helps finding a way forward. You need to combine all of this and do it. If you are there following national instructions, if you're there trying to help the Commission preserve some of their competencies in area, you're going to be a bad EIS official. You're not going to be a good official. You're not going to do your job, and you will lose credibility very quickly. And I think heads of delegations, when they go out, they find this very quickly, that if they start working on one agenda, it's going to be very difficult for them to be performing well. They need to bring all these elements to the table. So I think that's the push for the common culture, more than any training or any approaches that we can develop intellectually, is trying to see how can you do your job well and what are the expectations of your immediate counterparts, not so much in ideological terms. And I see very, very much the change, both on the side of colleagues coming in from the Commission, but also on colleagues coming in from the member states.
Thank you. Now, I know there are other people who want to come in, but what I'd suggest, if you don't mind, to pursue those bilaterally, or I'll pass your names on to the chairs for successive sessions so you can join the speedy boarding queue for entering the debate next time. But on your behalf, can I thank Cesare for being so candid in your assessment of where you're at. You, of course, now have invited all sorts of clogging up of your inbox with those suggestions for others who might be engaged in thinking about ideas for the future, so you might want to change your email address.
We can't.
But thank you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.